Jurors could not evaluate what he could not see, so Court waited here, just out of the sight line of his quarry. Court knew where Chris Travers lived because Court knew Chris Travers. Travers had been an SAD Ground Branch operations officer at the same time as Gentry. While they weren't on the same task force, they had trained together from time to time, and, to the extent Gentry got along with anyone, he had gotten along well with Travers. The first time they met was in Court's early days with the Goon Squad. Travers and some of his team were assigned to play the opposition force against Court's Gulf Sierra task force at a shoot house in Moyock, North Carolina. For 2 days, Zach Hightower and his boys, all jocked up in combat gear, kicked in the doors of the shoot house and cleared rooms, opening fire on the other team, who were all dressed in robes or other Middle Eastern attire. They fired simunitions at one another, plastic bullets loaded with paint that left a splotch on the clothing and blistering welts on the skin. After the training, the guys on both teams would go out to a local watering hole. For the most part, the teams stayed to themselves, but Travers saddled up next to the bar alongside Court and complimented him on his skills. He asked questions of a tactical nature, bought Court a couple of drinks, and rolled his eyes when Court's team leader, Zach Hightower, told Court to stop fraternizing with the enemy and sit with his Gulf Sierra unit. The last time Gentry and Travers had run into each other had been at a funeral in D.C. Court barely knew the Ground Branch officer who'd been killed, but Zach Hightower had mandated all his team to go to the funeral because they were in town that week and few other SAD shooters were around to pay their respects. Travers had been there. He'd been best friends with the man who had died, and after the funeral, he invited all the Ground Branch men in attendance to his place, just a few blocks away. It was a two-bedroom, second-floor walk-up in a part of town where 700-square-foot apartments sold for north of $1 million. When Hightower asked Travers if he'd taken to spying for the Chinese to pay his mortgage, Travers replied that his mom owned the building, and he lived here for free, and due to the deal he was getting and the convenience of the location, he wouldn't think about moving as long as he was CIA. Court remembered the location, and although he didn't know for sure if Travers was in town, as soon as he took up surveillance on the building tonight, he saw the second floor lights flip off, and his old colleague step off the stoop and head south on foot. Court had remained 100 yards back, keeping out of the streetlights, while he tracked the distant figure to an Irish pub on 19th Street. Confident he'd return home after a few drinks, Court retraced his steps and found an alley nearby with a place to sit and wait. He told himself it was Sunday night, and he doubted Travers would hang out at the bar till last call. He'd been wrong. Court was bored and freezing now, but not for much longer. So he shook his arms and stamped his feet to prepare himself for action. Travers had been a decent guy, Court remembered. But that was years ago, and in those intervening years, Travers had no doubt been told that Gentry was both a rampaging murderer and an enemy of America. Court was here to talk to his old acquaintance, but he knew he had to take the other man down quick and hard. It didn't have to get bloody, but Travers would make the ultimate determination of how rough things were going to go tonight. Now Travers passed along the sidewalk, moving abreast with the alleyway. Instinctively, the man's head turned to scan for threats in the dark, but it was already too late. Court stood there, face obscured, with his small pistol in his hands. In a tone that was measured perfectly to command attention without being loud enough to alert nearby apartment dwellers, Court said, "Hands on your head, Chris, or you die." Travers stopped in his tracks, and his hands rose slowly.
"What the fuck is this?"
"I'm going to search you for weapons. Then we are going up to your place."
"Who are you?"
Court knew the man wouldn't remember his voice, and there was no way Travers would recognize him from just his eyes in a darkened alley.
"I'm only a threat if you make me a threat. I just want to have a little talk."
"You can't talk without a gun?"
"Of course I can. The gun is so you talk. Turn around and back up to me."
Travers complied, clearly now aware that this man not only knew his name, but he also knew Travers had some training. Court pushed him up against the brick wall of the alleyway. While keeping his gun leveled at the man's back, Court felt over the man's waistband with his left hand. Finding nothing there, he checked Travers's pockets. He had a mobile phone, which Court slipped into his own pocket, a billfold, which Court left alone, and a set of keys, which Court took from the pocket and placed in Travers's left hand. Court then knelt quickly and grabbed at the man's ankles. There was no ankle holster.
"I'm not carrying," Travers said.
But Court wasn't finished. He reached around to the front of the SAD operator's body, grabbed the man's belt buckle, feeling for a knife there. Then he pulled Travers's shirt out of his pants and swept his hand up the man's chest. Hanging from a chain around Travers's neck, Court found a small blade in a sheath. He yanked the chain, breaking it free, and he threw it into the alley behind him. Travers grumbled.
"That cost me $300.
Court finished the frisk and stepped back.
"Bullshit. You can get them for 60 on the internet.
Who are you?
Move."
Chapter 17. Travers led the way to his building and up his stoop, used a key on his chain to unlock the door, then climbed the stairs and entered his own apartment with a second key. The space wasn't large, less than 1,000 square feet, and the living room was only 12 by 15. Court turned on the overhead, and Travers began moving towards the sofa. Court stopped him.
"Not there. Sit on the mantel in front of the fireplace. Hands on your lap where I can see them."
Travers did as instructed. Court moved to the couch and, with his gun trained on the other man, yanked up the cushions. The handle of the sheathed Bowie knife jutted out of the corner where the springs met the side of the sofa. Court pulled out the blade and tossed it on a side table.
"You are just full of tricks, aren't you?
And you seem to know every one. Again, who the fuck are you?"
Court sat down in a wicker chair next to the sofa, 10 feet away from the man seated on the hearth. He then lowered his neck gaiter and took his hood and his cap off his head.
"Sierra 6?
We both know what's about to happen."
Travers cocked his head.
"Maybe you do, but I don't have a fucking clue."
"Sure you do. You're going to act compliant. Wait for me to let my guard down a little. Say a bunch of shit about how we used to be buds, and you're going to look for your opportunity. As soon as you see any chance, you're going to take it."
"Why would I—"
"Just know that I'm expecting it, and also know that as soon as you fucking flinch, I'm putting 3 rounds through your heart."
Travers said,
"I don't know why you think I'm going to attack you, and I sure as fuck don't know why you are pointing a gun at me."
"Because you're SAD, and you have orders to kill me."
"Kill you? What the hell are you talking about? I haven't heard your name in years."
Court was impressed. Travers did a good job selling his story.
"Bullshit.
I swear it, man."
To that, Court just replied,
"Moscow."
"Moscow? What about Moscow?"
2 years ago, a market a couple blocks away from where I was staying, I saw you with another dude. I didn't know him, but he was a ground branch-looking motherfucker. I followed you back to your hotel, the Hilton Leningradskaya, then watched you leave with your partner and 4 other guys. A full 6-man element. I recognized Jenner. I figured him to be the team leader because he's been around since forever."
Court could see the wheels turning in Travers's brain, but to be fair, they turned fast.
"Yeah, okay, we were there, but it didn't have anything to do with you. Another op, code-worded, so I can't talk about it."
He paused, faked a little chuckle.
"I didn't see you at all. That's a hell of a coincidence, I'll give you that."
"You're full of shit. You guys were on my trail. You ran a full Monty surveillance op outside the place I was renting. Bad luck for you that I saw you first and left town before you got set up."
Court smiled.
"How long did you guys sit on the location before you realized I'd bugged out?"
Travers said,
"Man, you're just paranoid. I'm not after—"
"I know about the shoot on sight. I know Carmichael has JSOC and SAD hunting me all over the world. I know that's what you were doing in Moscow. The longer you sit here and deny it, the more pissed off I get while pointing a gun at your face. Right now might be a good time to do things to minimize my anger. Travers looked like he was going to keep up the ruse, but after a few seconds, he deflated, his shoulders drooping. He gave a shrug and a nod.
You win, Gentry.
After another shrug, he said,
If it makes you feel any better, I felt bad about it.
That's a huge comfort, Court said, then added, Asshole.
So, what are we doing? What do you want?
I want to know why. Why is there a shoot on sight out on me? Travers and Gentry made eye contact for several seconds, till Travers asked,
Why are you playing dumb?
Because I am dumb. I have a guess, but I don't know for sure. Tell me.
You're the enemy of the state, not me. Don't ask me what you did.
Come on. They told you why. What did they say? Travers heaved his shoulders and closed his eyes. In frustration, he said,
Dude, why'd you come back here? What the hell are you trying to accomplish?
I'm just trying to figure it out. To make it right.
Make it right? Jesus H. Christ, you really do not know why they are after you.
Tell me. Travers shrugged, and this gesture looked utterly real.
I don't know the specifics. Just that you were sent out on an op, you were given good intel and clear orders, and then went off script.
Travers winced, like he didn't want to say it.
You killed the wrong dude, bro.
What do you mean?
How else can I say it? You smoked the wrong guy. You capped a non-combatant. You fragged a friendly. You termed some innocent son of a bitch and fucked up the mission.
Court shook his head slowly.
No, that's not true. That must be disinformation Carmichael is using to get everyone on board with the term order. All my ops were solid. I never had an unauthorized termination.
Travers kept his eye on the gun.
Court, I didn't get it from Carmichael. You think door kickers like me hang out with Denny Carmichael?
Who told you?
Me and a lot of the guys asked for a full brief on the reasons behind the term order. We didn't like hunting one of our brothers. Know what I mean?
Yeah, Court thought. I know exactly what you mean. You mean you want me to lower this pistol because I'm supposed to act like we're just members of the same big happy family.
We were briefed by Jordan Mays and some big-shot lawyer from the Office of General Counsel. Chunky dude, German name, don't remember it. He wore this goofy bow tie, I do remember that. Anyway, he said you were derelict on a mission, but no one knew at the time. Years later, intel filtered from some foreign service to Carmichael, proving you zapped the wrong motherfucker. Bowtie dude told us Carmichael wanted you brought in for questioning. Your own task force was sent in to pick you up. And then you smoked them all.
Travers hesitated before saying the last part, as if he only just understood the repercussions of having a killer of CIA officers sitting in his apartment with a gun pointed at his chest. Court said nothing.
You going to tell me that didn't happen either?
Court kept the gun up, but his body sagged a little.
They weren't bringing me in. They were sent to terminate me.
Term you? Why would you be killed for schwacking an innocent person on a mission?
Shit happens. You might have been cashiered from the agency if the dereliction was bad enough, but they wouldn't kill you. Not for that.
Travers went on.
But once you killed your own guys, then it was on, bro. Denny has been after you ever since. You've done a hell of a good job hiding out, but if you kill me now, well, they'll just know you are here in town.
Court cocked his head in surprise.
Pretty sure they already know I'm here.
Travers rolled his head back as if he was looking to the heavens.
Well, I sure wish someone would have bothered to give me the heads up.
Look, you aren't going to believe me over this suit from General Counsel, but I was not derelict. I never fragged the wrong target. Not once, not ever, he added. And my team tried to murder me, not bring me in. I had to defend myself. Travers nodded like he believed, but Court didn't think for a minute that he'd convinced him. Travers said,
Okay, I guess they got it wrong. I'll let everybody know. That should fix things.
It was sarcasm, brave, considering Travers's situation, but it was clear to Court the other man wanted to show he was not afraid.
Court thought a moment. AAP. Does that mean anything to you?
Travers was taken aback by the question.
You mean that magazine for old people?
No, Chris, that's AARP. I'm talking about the Autonomous Asset Program. Did this guy from General Counsel say anything about that?
Travers shook his head.
I don't know what that is. He didn't mention it.
Sounds stupid.
Court sagged low on the couch, frustrated and confused. But then he nodded to himself. Softly, he said,
Carmichael needed an excuse to kill me, so he came up with a cover story. He had to erase the AAP, terminate all the participants, but they couldn't breathe a word about it to anyone. They blamed me for some imaginary screw-up.
Whatever you say, dude,
Travers said. He hadn't heard everything because Court had been speaking to himself. Court ignored him and stood up slowly.
What are you going to do?
Travers asked, letting a little nervousness show in his voice now.
I'm leaving. You are useless. You know even less about what went down than I do.
Then he said,
Stand up.
Travers did so. Court reached into his coat and pulled out zip ties. The other man's eyes widened just a little, but he made no comment.
Court said, Your lucky day, right? You know how to get out of these in 5 seconds. Put them on, behind your back.
Travers followed Gentry's orders, confused. He did know how to defeat zip ties, even when his arms were fastened behind his back. But if Gentry knew this already, why was he using them? When his arms were secured, Court walked up to him and spun him around. A second later, Travers heard the sound of thick duct tape being pulled from a roll.
You motherfucker, he mumbled.
The zip ties were just to keep his hands down while Court restrained him in a way that would be much harder to defeat. 5 minutes later, Travers's arms and hands were completely secured, from the shoulders all the way down to the fingertips, with an entire roll of duct tape. His ankles were bound with wires from 2 table lamps. He sat on the floor, arms outstretched behind him like a single wing, and his feet in front of him, lashed together. Once Court was finished, he knelt over the other man and surveyed his work.
You look ridiculous, he said. I've got to piss. Just think of that as additional incentive.
Court patted the other man on the head.
Good to see you, Chris.
He headed for the door.
Fuck you! Seriously, how the hell am I supposed to get out of this?
Court flipped off the overhead in the living room. The only remaining light was from the street, filtering in through the curtains. He said,
If this equation takes you more than 10 minutes to solve, then you are a poor excuse for an asset.
Court reached for the door latch. Travers called after him.
Hey, Court!
Yeah?
Travers paused, then said,
I'm going to tell you this as a friend. I really hope you'll take my advice. Run. Just fucking run. You had the right plan, staying off-grid, out of the States. That was working for you. There is no future to you sticking around here. Trust me on that. Now that you're here, now that they know, they'll rain down on you with everything they have and they will kill you.
I suspect you're right,
Court said, and he left Travers there alone in the dark. It was well after 2 a.m. when Court pulled into a little market and gas station a mile from his long-term storage unit in Columbia Heights. He'd been driving around for a while, rolling into and then back out of a half-dozen other convenience store parking lots, because he was looking for a very specific setup. He needed a place with poor CCTV camera coverage of the parking lot. Court took it on faith that the U.S. government would have access to civilian CCTV networks here in the area. They would also have facial recognition software working to identify him as he moved around the city. While there was nothing Court could do to avoid getting picked up on cameras inside stores, he couldn't very well wear a ski mask as he shopped. He knew it was in his best interest to show neither his face nor his vehicle on camera. Court could mitigate the risk to himself by never going to the same place more than once. By the time he was identified on camera and CIA or police arrived to investigate, hours would have passed. Court merely had to know better than to ever return. But if he allowed his image to be recorded and identified, and he allowed his vehicle to be identified by parking it in view of a CCTV camera, then he would be screwed, because he couldn't very well change cars every time he went out into the city. The parking lots of the first six late-night markets he pulled into had good camera coverage, with no place to park without exposing his vehicle. The seventh store, to Court's great relief, did have a couple of outdoor cameras near the pumps, but the store's owners were cutting corners and relying on the inside camera to film a portion of the lot near the window. Court only had to pull up to one side of the front window or the other, park in a space there, and then go inside. Court stepped carefully into the Easy Market on Rhode Island with his head down. He lowered his hood, but he left his baseball cap on, low in front of his face. He moved slowly to the back corner of the establishment, far away from the register, and he pretended to look through the cooler for a drink. Soon, he glanced up and around the little shop, scanning high and in the corners, searching for cameras. And Court liked what he saw. Not only had the management here gone cheap with the cams outside, two of the cameras inside the market were hanging down with wires unplugged, clearly out of commission. A third camera was set up to the right of the front register facing down, but Court determined he could defeat it with his cap and by turning his face away from the proper angle needed for a successful facial recog. Within 1 minute of passing through the door, Court decided he would become a faithful customer here at the Easy Market on Rhode Island Avenue. Court grabbed a few items off shelves, more duct tape, a few cans of food, a bottle of water, and a candy bar. Then, he carefully stepped up to the register at a 45-degree angle, with his head turned slightly to the left, and the bill of his baseball cap slightly cocked to the right. A lone clerk stood behind the counter, watching his approach. She was mid-twenties, heavy-set, and African-American. Her name tag read, LaChandra. When Court put his items up on the counter, he glanced at her again and noticed she had a severely lazy left eye, with the pupil drooping down. She looked tired, but she wore a kind smile.
"Hey, baby doll, how's your night going?"
"Baby doll? It's going," Court said, looking to the left.
He paid for the tape, the canned food, the water, and a candy bar, and LaChandra put it all into a plastic bag. While he waited, Court spent his time scanning reflective surfaces behind the woman, making sure there were no threats behind him. He glanced to his left, back out to the parking lot, and saw that it remained clear. He was careful, however, to avoid looking to the right, where the camera hung down pointing at him, just 8 feet away. As he left the store, careful to avoid looking up to the camera recording the front two aisles of the market, the clerk called after him.
"You have a good night now, honey."
"You too," Court muttered on his way out the door.
As he climbed into his car, Court realized that he hadn't carried on such a pleasant conversation with anyone in a long time. Chapter 18. On most days of the work week, Leland Babbitt left his Chevy Chase home around 7:45 a.m. to make it into his office in the district by 8:30. But this Monday morning, his garage door hummed and opened at a quarter till seven, and Babbitt emerged behind the wheel of his silver Lexus and backed down the driveway out onto the street. A black Lincoln Navigator sat parked in front of Babbitt's home, and inside it, four men raised their hands toward Babbitt's car. Babbitt acknowledged them briefly with a nod as he passed them by. He wasn't going to stop to chat with his home protection detail. He had somewhere important to be today, a clandestine rendezvous arranged with a high-profile official, so his attention was focused on beating the traffic and making it to his destination in plenty of time. A half hour later, Babbitt parked in the lot by the Capitol reflecting pool, climbed out of his Lexus, and pulled on a trench coat, and then he began walking west along the National Mall. Leland Babbitt was director of Townsend Government Services, a private intelligence and security firm that worked on classified projects for the United States intelligence community. Townsend had been around for 150 years, making a big name in an extremely low-profile industry by employing some of the best headhunters in the world. Townsend had gotten its start in the Old West when its investigators tracked down train robbers, bank robbers, even marauding renegade Indians. In the following century, Townsend hunted Nazis and Russian spies. It helped catch Noriega and Serbian war criminals, and in the 2000s, it had a hand in the capture of Saddam Hussein, as well as many of the leadership of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations. But on its most recent mission, Townsend Government Services had failed unequivocally. Leland Babbitt and his company had been chasing the gray man for years on a cost-plus contract with the U.S. government. They'd come to within a hair's breadth of killing him in Brussels. Babbitt himself had been there at the scene during the gun battle. Unfortunately for everyone, Gentry had escaped, and in the process, he'd killed some of Babbitt's men and wounded others. The shootout in Brussels had been a major news event, of course, and although Babbitt had managed to avoid exposure in the media for himself and his firm, since Brussels, Denny Carmichael had treated Lee Babbitt like he had the plague. The director of the National Clandestine Service had flatly refused every meeting, every teleconference, even private phone conversations with the director of Townsend since he'd returned to the U.S. Only a few clipped and business-like emails had come from Carmichael to Babbitt, and these made clear that NCS was indefinitely suspending its contracts with Townsend and removing the private firm's access to classified material. Babbitt understood Carmichael's frustrations in a general sense. For some reason, Carmichael's involvement in the Gentry hunt was very personal. So, after the debacle in Europe, it was no surprise that the head of NCS would naturally try to scapegoat Townsend. But Lee Babbitt had grown weary of the cold shoulder, and he was determined to end his company's exile from clandestine work and get things back on track. To this end, Babbitt had emailed Carmichael over the weekend, insisting the two men sit for a face-to-face to put the matter to rest. Babbitt took into account the fact Carmichael was obviously trying to distance himself publicly from the happenings in Belgium, so he suggested an old-fashioned clandestine rendezvous. He gave Carmichael directions to a quiet location, told him he'd be there at 7:30, ready to do whatever he needed to do to end the rift and reboot the important mutual relationship between Townsend and the CIA. Denny Carmichael hadn't exactly agreed to the meeting, but he had not expressly declined it either, and Babbitt felt like Denny would come to the realization that a continued partnership between CIA and Townsend Government Services was in everyone's best interests. Denny would show, he told himself. Babbitt had mentally prepared himself for a verbal beating from the grizzled spymaster. He knew his company hadn't done what the CIA had sent it to do, but he was ready to spin it by reminding Carmichael that he had gotten closer to Gentry than the CIA had, and Carmichael should simply send Babbitt back out after the gray man. Court Gentry had lived out his 9 lives. Next time, they would get him for sure. Babbitt walked directly from his car to the meeting site. He knew he should have conducted some sort of surveillance detection route, but this was the fucking USA, and he was certain nobody was tailing him. Plus, he was too angry and focused on returning his forces to the Gentry hunt to devote attention to anything other than getting to his rendezvous and giving the person he'd meet there a very measured dose of his rage. While Babbitt walked to his destination, thinking about how much he wanted just one more opportunity to hunt Court Gentry again, the object of his thoughts was exactly 150 yards away, jogging along the National Mall, doing his best to catch up with the man in the Burberry trench coat before he lost him. Gentry had been on the man's tail since just before dawn. He'd found Babbitt's home in Chevy Chase on uscrypto.org, and he'd parked his car in a little lot in front of a pair of tennis courts near a country club. He'd used the cover of the thick foliage on the edge of a golf course to get close to Babbitt's property, and then he'd spent a cold, miserable hour under a magnolia tree in a neighbor's yard surveilling the house. Court hadn't been surprised to see Babbitt had a security detail at his place. He was, after all, president of a security firm. A black SUV with four men sat parked in front, and two more men wandered the acre of property. Court stayed well out of sight of any curious eyes, just squatting there against the tree trunk, watching the house. At 6:45, the garage door opened and Babbitt rolled down the drive in his silver Lexus. Court didn't stick around to see where he went. Instead, he jogged back across a golf course to his car. He had just climbed behind the wheel when the Lexus passed in front of him on Connecticut, and he fell into an easy tail behind it. Babbitt drove straight towards the city, finally parking in a lot near the Capitol building's reflecting pool. He climbed out and began walking towards the National Mall. Court was confused. He'd assumed the man would be heading to his office, which, Court knew, was in the Townsend Government Services building in Adams Morgan. But instead of this, Court now found himself scrambling to find a parking space and to begin a hasty one-man foot-follow operation. Court found a spot for his escort just south of the mall and jogged back to where he had last seen Babbitt. Using his binoculars, he caught a quick glimpse of his target at a distance as he walked west along Madison Drive. Court picked up his pace to catch up to him. The area was full of early morning joggers, so Court didn't stand out save for the fact that he was wearing brown work boots, and slipped into a tailing position 65 yards behind. Soon, Babbitt turned right into the Smithsonian Gardens butterfly habitat, a set of two footpaths that ran through a thick garden of various types of dense foliage. Court doubted Babbitt was so into butterflies that he'd begin his work week with them, so he presumed Babbitt was here for some sort of clandestine meet. Of course, Court knew there was also a chance Babbitt was here for a Monday morning hookup with a girlfriend, or a boyfriend for that matter, but the more Court thought about it, the more he wondered if the director of Townsend was here to link up with someone senior in the CIA. Maybe even Carmichael? It was almost too much to hope for. A lightly protected CIA exec, a man directly invested in the hunt for Gentry, out in the open where Gentry could bag him on just Gentry's second full day of his op here in the U.S. But Court thought it was possible. He knew Leland Babbitt ran a private military company here in D.C. They had been part of the chase, and they had nearly gotten him in Stockholm and in Hamburg. In Brussels, they had gotten so close, Court now wore a bright red scar in the shape of a bullet hole on his right forearm. Court wondered if Townsend was hunting him here in D.C. as well. He found himself getting excited that Denny Carmichael might just walk up the narrow path any minute. If he did, Court would deal with whatever security force Denny had with him. This wouldn't be easy, but the opportunity would be too good to pass up. Then Court would find a way to get Denny back to his car, take him to his storage unit, and beat the truth out of him. "Settle down, Gentry," he said to himself. Bagging and zip-tying a nation's chief spook wouldn't be easy anywhere, not even in Paraguay or Namibia. Here in D.C., surely it would be virtually impossible. Court forced himself to lower his sights a little. If Carmichael showed, Court would evaluate the situation. He doubted he could bag the man himself, so he'd just watch, listen in if he could, and wait for them to part ways. He'd stay on mission, following Babbitt back to his car and taking him at gunpoint as he climbed in. Babbitt remained the target. Court moved a little closer, then tucked himself into the foliage of the butterfly habitat and watched his target from behind and 100 feet away. He placed the walker's game ear behind his right ear and turned the volume up. Chapter 19. While Leland Babbitt sat on a bench in an outdoor butterfly garden near the U.S. Capitol building, staring at his watch and wondering when the hell Denny Carmichael would show up, Carmichael was 5.5 miles to the west, sitting in his 7th-floor office at CIA, sipping coffee and reading his morning Violator Working Group report. The report started on a down note. There had been a grand total of 0 positive IDs of gentry the day before. Facial recog had gotten quite a few possible sightings, and analysts in the Violator Task Force were evaluating these hits now. But Brewer said she'd looked at all the images, and to her, nothing appeared terribly promising. That was the bad news. The good news was that the facial recognition software had been tweaked and retooled overnight, using some newer images of Gentry taken from security camera images out of Belgium, and the technicians felt confident they would, sooner or later, pick him out from the millions of human faces from thousands of video feeds in the DC metro area. Still, Denny had his doubts the Violator Operations Center would get much out of facial recognition. No, Gentry was too good for that. He would mask himself 12 different ways to spoof the software. Next in the report, Brewer wrote that JSOC operatives were up and running in the city, ready to be vectored to the right location as soon as there was more information to go on. 2 men were also overwatching the home of SAD Director Matthew Hanley, in the hopes Gentry would show up to question or to kill his former boss. The report also confirmed that 30 contracted assets were on station in the area, watching known associates of Violator. This wasn't in the report, of course, but Carmichael also knew the Saudis would be deployed in the district. He hadn't spoken with Kaz since he'd left him in the Kimpton in Alexandria the afternoon before, but Carmichael knew Kaz would waste no time getting his operation in gear. Carmichael was confident one of the myriad elements involved in the hunt would locate Gentry soon, but he also suspected the action would only really start the second Gentry did something to expose himself to the hunters. He would make his play, contact a known associate, or show himself at a CIA facility, and CIA would be ready. And while Mays sent JSOC and other assets, Denny would send the Saudis to cover any escape. Court Gentry was going to die here in D.C., Carmichael felt certain. The only real worry was making sure it happened without either the media or the Department of Justice finding out about it. Just then, his intercom beeped. His secretary's voice came over the speaker.
"Sorry, sir, I know you asked not to be disturbed, but Department Director Hanley is here to see you."
Carmichael put down the report and pushed the call button.
"I didn't see an appointment on the calendar."
"No, sir, but he is insistent."
"Of course he is," Carmichael thought. "Prick," he said aloud, then pushed the talk button again. "Send him in."
Matthew Hanley was a burly man, like a college linebacker who'd hit his 50s much harder than he would have liked, but still retained the ability to kick a much younger man's ass if it came down to it. When he entered through the doorway, Carmichael noted the SAD director filled the doorframe nearly as completely as he filled his gray flannel suit, and it wasn't until he stepped fully into the office that Denny realized Hanley had another man in tow. Carmichael offered a fake smile, but he didn't stand or step around his desk to offer a handshake.
"Morning, Matt. What is it that couldn't wait till you got on my calendar? And who's this?"
Hanley said,
"This is Travers. He's on Jenner's team." "Travers," Carmichael said, his version of a greeting, and he scooped up the paperwork in front of him, anxious to get back to it.
Hanley's voice was twice as loud as Carmichael's now.
"Tell me you did not know Court Gentry was here in the city."
Carmichael lowered his paper again and looked back up. Suddenly, he found himself significantly more interested in this impromptu meeting.
"You saw him?"
Hanley's jaw tightened.
"Son of a bitch, Denny! You knew?"
"Shut the door and come in."
Hanley nearly slammed the door. Then he and Travers stepped over to Carmichael's desk. Travers remained standing while Hanley took the chair. Before anyone spoke, Carmichael hit a button on the console on his desk.
Get Mays in here, now.
He turned his attention back to Hanley and asked,
What did he say?
Hanley jerked his head to the man left standing.
Ask Travers.
Carmichael raised an eyebrow and looked to the younger man.
Talk.
Travers was clearly nervous standing in the office of the legendary Denny Carmichael, but he composed himself.
He got me at gunpoint last night.
Carmichael snapped back.
I thought you guys were supposed to be good.
Travers did not reply, but Hanley spoke in his defense.
Come on, it's Gentry we're talking about.
Right, said Carmichael.
Quickly, he looked down to Brewer's report. On the last page was a list of Gentry's known associates that she had covered with Watchers. There was no mention of Travers on the list. He looked back up to the ground branch officer.
Did you two know each other?
Barely. I'd met him a couple of times. We'd trained together some at Harvey Point and at Blackwater, and I had the Golf Sierra team over to my apartment once after a funeral. That's how he knew where I lived.
I see he let you go. Why do you think he did that?
Because I didn't have what he wanted.
And that was?
Answers. Just answers. He wanted to know what he did to initiate the SOS.
I told him what I knew.
That he waxed the wrong target on an op and then killed his team when they tried to detain him. He said he didn't fuck up, and his team fired first.
Carmichael shook his head.
He knows what happened. He's here trying to get intel on the executives involved in his hunt. He'll target us one by one to exact his revenge.
Hanley asked,
How long has he been here?
Less than 36 hours. I'm confident we'll have him in hand soon enough. We have control of the situation.
Undoubtedly, replied Hanley. And by control, you mean Gentry is allowed to wander the city freely with a gun in his hand while he targets the homes of agency employees. What's the game plan, Denny? You just trying to lull him into a false sense of security before you drop the cage down over him?
Carmichael rolled his eyes.
He was your man when he went off reservation.
And it was because of your order that he went off res.
Travers looked back and forth between the two men, his mouth shut tightly. Like most CIA officers, he was good at keeping secrets, but he couldn't fucking wait to tell the other guys on his team about standing up here in Carmichael's office, watching the old man and Hanley duke it out. Jordan Mays entered the room now, and Carmichael filled him in. As soon as he finished, Mays turned to the younger paramilitary officer.
Travers, when you leave here, I want you to go find Susan Brewer. Tell her every last detail.
Hanley was confused.
What does Brewer have to do with Gentry?
Mays replied.
She's running the TOC.
Hanley sighed.
Brewer from Programs and Plans knows all about this, but the director of the Special Activities Division does not. Why is that, Denny? Why am I not involved? If Gentry is a legitimate danger, then why wasn't I told?
Calm down. You've been protected.
What the hell does that mean?
I've had a team of operatives watching your house.
Without my knowledge?
Carmichael just shrugged.
I've had a lot on my plate. I was getting to it.
What operatives? You can't task my guys without informing me.
They aren't your guys.
Carmichael hesitated.
They are part of a special mission unit from JSOC.
Hanley looked like he'd been pole-axed. He leaned all the way back in his chair. In a nearly hoarse voice, he said,
What in the name of God are you doing?
I wasn't planning on using SAD. I have sanctioned to pull certain military assets from...
Why?
Hanley quickly put a hand up in the air.
Why not tell me and call up Ground Branch Assets?
He sat up straighter in his chair and raised a finger.
I get it. You are using me as bait.
Carmichael grinned like a cornered dog showing his teeth.
He'll try to make contact with you. You know he will.
Meaning, you think he'll try to kill me?
Carmichael did not respond for a moment. Finally, he picked up the report again.
You'll be safe.
Despite your best attempts to keep me out of the loop, Gentry has made other arrangements. Now I'm involved, whether you like it or not. I know what's going on here. I know you are doing your best to keep this whole thing under wraps. For the sake of the agency, I hope you do keep a lid on it. If U.S. military forces go loud on the streets of Washington, D.C., some really curious folks are going to want to know why. Carmichael replied, I am well aware of that. He drummed his fingers on the table now. I suppose some support from Ground Branch wouldn't hurt. Why don't you task a few elements to my Violator working group? We can involve them in the hunt, wrap this up even faster.
Matt Hanley shook his head with a laugh.
You've got some brass balls, Denny. Trying to suck me into your debacle in the making so I'll be invested in the outcome? No, thank you.
I will remind you that I am your superior. Your men are ultimately mine to do with as I see fit.
Hanley stood.
Can't argue with you there. My guys are at your disposal.
He started to turn for the door. Then he stopped himself and turned back.
Of course, I can always drop by the director's office. On something this big, you don't mind if I check with him just to make sure everything is squared away.
Carmichael's jaw flexed.
On second thought, maybe SAD should sit this one out. I'm sure your operational tempo is keeping your forces busy.
As a bee, said Hanley.
It was quiet now, as two men who neither trusted nor liked each other squared off. Finally, Carmichael looked back down to his paperwork and said,
Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a lot of work on my desk.
The meeting was over, but to the surprise of the senior executives, Chris Travers spoke up.
Sorry, can I ask a question, sir?
Carmichael looked up, annoyed.
What is it? If Gentry really did what we accuse him of, why the hell would he come back, grab me like he did, question me like he did, and then just leave? I've been thinking about it all night. If he wanted to hunt down the people after him, why expose himself like that? He's too smart to give away a tactical advantage.
Hanley looked to Carmichael, his eyebrows raised, waiting to hear the older man's response. Carmichael said,
I have stopped trying to understand all of Gentry's motivations. Did it make sense that he would eliminate his team and go on the run like that?
Travers said,
If what he says is true, if they did shoot first, then yeah, it does make sense. I love my team like brothers, but if they draw guns on me, I'm gonna do the same to them and somebody's gonna die.
Carmichael said,
Son, you are not cleared for the op that got Gentry in hot water in the first place, so you are not cleared for anything that Gentry told you last night. That means the questions you are asking me are out of line.
Mays took over now, ending the meeting by ushering Hanley and Travers towards the door. As they walked off, Hanley put an arm around his younger employee. In a voice loud enough for all to hear, Hanley said,
Don't feel bad, Chris. I'm not cleared for it either. Denny is the only one in the building with enough juice to know what Court did to put him in the CIA's crosshairs. I bet Mays here is flying as blind as the rest of us.
The two men left the room. Mays shut the door, then turned back to Carmichael. Carmichael said,
Don't worry about Hanley. Despite his posturing, he's in this as deep as me. If we leave him alone, he'll continue to play ball.
Mays said,
I'm not worried about Hanley. He makes noise, but he always comes around. He knows you are the law around here, not the director. I am, however, a little concerned about this Travers. I could see him becoming a problem.
Carmichael nodded and said,
Agreed. He's unreliable. I don't want him operational until the Violator situation is resolved.
Carmichael quickly put up a hand.
Belay that. I want him out. All the way out.
Mays whistled.
Hanley is going to fight that tooth and nail. Come up with something. Unfit for duty, sketchy psych eval, doctored blood work, whatever.
Hanley won't be able to contest a positive drug screen. The intercom buzzed again, and Carmichael's secretary said,
Sir, you have an urgent call from Leland Babbitt.
Carmichael rolled his eyes.
I forgot. That bastard emailed me on Saturday, basically demanded I meet him this morning.
Mays said,
I don't want you leaving the building again unless it's to go to a safe house.
Carmichael chuckled without smiling.
I'm not going anywhere.
He pushed the button for his secretary.
Put him through.
Chapter 20. Court Gentry stood tucked into the dense foliage of the Smithsonian's butterfly sanctuary, watching Leland Babbitt from a distance of 100 feet. His high hopes for getting his eyes on Denny Carmichael took their first hit of the day when he noticed Babbitt continually checking his watch. Then, he began nervously pacing back and forth, and soon it became clear that whoever Babbitt was here to meet was late. At 8:15, Babbitt pulled out his phone and dialed a number. Court wouldn't be able to hear the conversation. His high-powered earpiece was picking up every bird chirp and passing vehicle, so he turned it off. And instead, he just stood there in the bushes, looking on. Leland Babbitt continued pacing, waiting for Carmichael to come on the phone. When he finally did, Babbitt looked up and down the path before speaking quickly and quietly, spending no time on pleasantries.
It's 8:15, Denny. You were supposed to be here a half hour ago.
Denny Carmichael replied.
I didn't agree to come at all. I just said I'd think about it.
Oh, come on, Denny. We need a face-to-face.
No, we don't. You and I won't be doing any face-to-face meetings anytime soon. I don't want you at Langley, of course, and I sure as hell don't want to set foot at Townsend in light of all the exposure you've had in the past 2 weeks.
Babbitt's voice rose and fell with desperation.
I get that. That's why I proposed off-site, a neutral location. You and me, we can put this to bed and move forward.
Carmichael said,
Lee, let's give it the time it needs to die down.
Babbitt gritted his teeth. His fleshy jowls rolled with the movement.
You aren't going to leave me to swing in the wind on this.
For now, Lee, that's exactly what I'm doing.
You pulled our access to classified data. How the fuck are we supposed to stay in business?
I have no doubt that Townsend will be able to find lucrative security contracts in the commercial sector.
We're American patriots. We're not fucking mall cops.
Carmichael did not respond. After taking a moment to calm himself, Babbitt said,
You aren't the only game in town, you know.
Was that some sort of a threat?
It is what it is.
Carmichael growled.
Fuck you, Babbitt. No, Denny, fuck you. As a matter of fact, I think I'll do just that right now.
Lee Babbitt hung up the phone, stood up from the bench, and reached back like he was going to throw the phone into the trees. But he stopped himself, slipped it back in his pocket, and began walking up the path towards the National Mall. Babbitt walked back out onto the road running alongside the National Mall, with Gentry trailing 200 feet behind. And while the butterfly sanctuary had been nearly empty, the road and the mall were chock-full of commuters, morning walkers and joggers, patrolling cops and tourists. Court wouldn't be pulling his gun on anyone right here, right now. Babbitt walked right past his car in the lot at the reflecting pool and continued on. Court stopped under a cherry tree, not yet in bloom, and he let Babbitt go. To Court's surprise, the big man headed straight towards the Capitol building. Softly, Court said,
What the hell are you doing now?
Babbitt disappeared heading into the east portico, and Gentry headed south, back in the direction of his car. As he walked, he took his hand off the small Ruger pistol he carried in the left-hand pocket of his jacket, and he used the same hand to pull his baseball cap down lower over his eyes. His right hand remained in his pants pocket, which kept his sore arm from swinging while he walked. He stopped at a hot dog cart on the mall, bought a bottled water, and drank a few sips while he stood there, allowing himself one last glance at the U.S. Capitol.
This was his first real look at the building since he'd been back in town, the first time he took the opportunity to take in any of the sights here in D.C. For 5 long years, he'd been outside of the USA, and each and every day during that time, he'd thought something of his home. Now that he was back, he couldn't allow himself the luxury of devoting any real time to enjoying himself, to relaxing, or to appreciating his triumphant return, such as it was. But for just this moment, he gazed upon one of the greatest structures in America, and he felt the power of the symbol and the love for his country in his heart, deep in his bones. He shook away the moment. Despite the emotions welling inside him, it would not do to stop and stare. He was in cover, and his cover wasn't some wide-eyed foreign tourist. And if he blew his cover now, agents of the America he loved so much would find him and shoot him dead in the street. But his cover was solid, because, unlike all of his other operations, in this rare case, his cover identity matched his true identity. He was American. He'd been gone for a while, but he was still American, and now he was home. Court tossed the empty water bottle in a garbage can, turned, and headed back to his car, still wondering what the hell Babbitt was planning on doing in the Capitol. Leland Babbitt stormed through the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, his Burberry coat whipping along with his brisk gait. He waved his credentials to make his way towards the congressional offices. It was just after 8:30 a.m., and he had no idea who would be here this early, but Congress was in session, so at least legislators were in town. His mind raced as he tried to decide where to go for help. He knew Mike Avery, a Republican senator from Utah, and the president pro tem. Avery was one of the most powerful personalities in Congress, and Babbitt liked the man. But Avery wasn't particularly interested in matters involving the intelligence community and Homeland Security, so Babbitt eliminated him from his list of potential recipients of his bombshell. He also knew Joel Landers, the Democratic congressman from New Mexico, who chaired the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Landers was a firebrand, always looking for something to bitch about when it came to the CIA. Babbitt thought about everything he knew concerning Carmichael and his 5-year-long hunt to kill an American citizen. Yeah, Representative Landers would love to hear his story. Of course, Babbitt knew what he was doing was professional suicide. He'd never get another government contract if he sold Carmichael out, even if Carmichael was led off to Club Fed in chains. But Babbitt knew he could still write books and give lucrative seminars on corporate security. He'd never work in this town again, as the saying went, but he would find work, and more importantly, he'd take down Denny Carmichael. Babbitt continued toward Representative Lander's office. Even if Joel wasn't in yet, he could camp out in his outer office till he showed and ask for 5 minutes as soon as he came in, and in those 5 minutes, Babbitt knew he would blow the congressman's mind. He pushed through a group of legislative aides standing in the hall and found himself just 50 feet from the representative's office when a young man in a gray suit passing on his left in the corridor turned suddenly into his path.
"Sir, may I speak with you a moment?"
"What about?" snapped Babbitt.
"Director Carmichael asked me to intercept you before you do anything you will regret."
Immediately, Babbitt's pounding heart skipped a beat. His eyes narrowed.
"You tell your boss that he had his chance to make things right. Now it's my move."
"You should tell him yourself. He'd like you to come to Langley. Now."
"Would he?" "I bet he would. No thanks. I..."
A second man appeared from nowhere. He loomed behind on Babbitt's left, put a hand on Babbitt's shoulder, and leaned in uncomfortably close.
"We can take my car. We'll have you right back here in no time."
Another hand squeezed his right shoulder now. Babbitt turned to look, and a third man had materialized from thin air. They were all under 30, all wearing suits, and they all looked at him with pleasant smiles that, Babbitt knew, would disappear quickly if he did not do exactly what Carmichael wanted him to do.
Fine, he said, shaking the hands off his shoulders. Let's go talk to Denny. Chapter 21
Leland Babbitt knew relations between Townsend and the CIA had never been worse, but the fact that he was here, walking down the corridor on the 7th floor at Langley, meant he still had the juice.